Blog Talk Radio.
Sun's on my back, wind's in my ears.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, this is Kelly Waters. I was supposed to call in to talk to Jim.
And this is Jan Hitchcock waiting also.
Oh, okay. So you're there as well.
We're here. That's good. I'm glad to hear that.
I've never done this before, so I was like, oh, okay. Oh, are you? So you're the one that will be talking to me?
No, I'm going to be, well, I may be involved also in one of the other guests.
Oh, okay.
Talking about poetry and psychology and change.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I understand you're going to be talking about the Westbrook Library and its impact.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It's had quite an impact.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing about that.
Yeah, it's. I think it's reached a level that no one thought it would, as far as how many people it has affected. And I don't think the city was quite ready for the outcry. so it's very interesting. It's nothing that I've ever thought I would be into before, but yeah. But
yeah, this was, I think I read about this. So is one of two libraries, or I'll be curious to hear what makes this library special.
It used to have theater groups. Autism groups. It set itself apart because of the arts that went along with it. Like they used to have theater groups upstairs and art galleries. Its collection sets itself apart from Walker in many ways. Walker's a beautiful library, and I have a card down there as well. But it just has a collection of its own that sets itself apart, and the staff, and just when you walk in there, it's just very cozy. It's very cozy.
So it really engages the community, it sounds like.
It really does, and I was amazed at how many people were upset. Because I honestly thought I'd be the only one upset, but it's great to see others feel the same way that I do about it, that it had some kind of special meaning or some kind of, it was there for them at certain points in their life, and they haven't forgotten. You know, either their children went there for story time, or they went there themselves on a, you know, Saturday afternoon because that's what they look forward to. So it's just kind of amazing to hear the stories that I'm trying to save all the stories that are coming to me via email just because I just find them very intriguing.
Well, that'd be a neat collection in its own right, wouldn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's just so great to hear. I mean, I'm hearing stories that my grandfather went there to learn how to speak English to, you know, my son used to go there to study, or I did homework there to, you know, it's just, it's very, I've met a lot of great people through the community because of this, so, yeah. It's right down on, do you know your way around Westbrook?
No, I don't.
Okay, it's right where S.D. Warren is, or Savvy Mill.
I really am not familiar with that community.
Oh, okay. It's right by the mill is where that is. So.
Well, that's significant too, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Kind of ironic because we're talking on the online and on the Internet, and that connects in different ways, but there's something very tangible about libraries in a community.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Now, are you from Maine? Are you from around here?
Well, I've been living in Maine for about 20 years. I teach at the University of Southern Maine at Lewis and Auburn College.
Oh, wow.
And I actually live down east Maine. It's kind of complicated. I've been in a couple different areas in Maine, but I've never actually lived in Portland area or around
Do you teach psychology?
Yes, I do. Psychology-related courses, but it's the college where people can pursue different disciplines in an interdisciplinary kind of way, and so I've been teaching related to the humanities as well, and that's where the words come in. I teach a course about poetry and psychology.
Very nice.
Yeah, that's
interesting.
It has been. Well, isn't this kind of strange? Why, I kind of thought we'd hear the beginning of the show some.
Yeah, I didn't know how he wanted to do this because I've never...
Oh. Yeah. Hi, can you hear me?
I can. Is this Jim?
Yeah.
It's Kelly Waters.
And Jan Hitchcock.
Hi, guys. You know, thank you for doing the show for me. For some reason, my microphone wasn't working, and I was talking to you guys, and you couldn't hear me.
Oh. Now, were we online? Because I was mindful of that possibility. I was surprised.
Yeah, but you have carried on brilliantly. I could hear you.
Oh no!
Yeah, no. I had a feeling that might be happening, so I was careful not to say anything.
I'm not sure what happened, but anyway, I'm here now. I've got another microphone. Can you hear me fine now?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right.
I'm good for stepping into things. So.
Yeah. So you both actually introduced yourself very well. Kelly, I wanted to start with you.
Okay.
You've talked a lot about the library and so forth. And one of the things that intrigued me about what you had said was that the library saved your life.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. If you're familiar with Westbrook, Brown Street is a pretty rough street as far as crime and, criminal activity, I could say. We grew up down by the Black Bridge. My mom, my siblings, and I, our family grew up beside the Black Bridge in the apartment building. And my mom was very strict, and we were, only allowed to do certain things. And, I had the choice to either go outside and hang on the Black Bridge and, my peers were graffitiing the bridge and, doing stuff that I knew was wrong and would come back to get me in trouble with mom. So I just chose to go to the library as my safe place. And it was in walking distance, but to get there I had to cross the Black Bridge. And, I remember sprinting across the Black Bridge trying to I would go past things that I normally... I look back and know what it was. You had folks that were doing drugs, smoking marijuana to drinking in broad daylight and doing some questionable things that I look back now and go, oh, my God, I can't believe my mom didn't like it. No wonder she got upset at me for doing that. But I would sprint and greet the workers, the librarians at the door when they were opening. And I remember sitting on the front stoop of the library waiting for them and, there used to be lilac trees out front before they moved the library back. They're gone now, but I remember sitting there waiting for them, and they would see me and be like, oh, you're back again. And, it was kind of like their mascot. So, and that's what it means to me is that, it did so much for me back then that, I'm not sure if I answered that right.
You answered it, in a very touching way. I think that's wonderful that was there for you and that you could have that resource of something to in competition with all the other negative things that were going on. So let me give the website for people who are interested in helping with the Friends of the Warren Library, and that is www.friendsofwarrenlibrary.giving.officelive.com.
Correct.
And you can go there and see ways that you can help and see if you can be part of saving the library. And I heard you talking about it and all the wonderful things that it meant to you.
I'm also still on Facebook. If anyone.
Oh, you are.
Facebook.
Okay.
Yes, I'm up to. I think we're past 600 or close to 600 members. And
oh, wonderful.
Yeah,
okay.
And it climbed, so.
Excellent. So thank you very much, Kelly. I'm going to switch to you now, Jan. And you've got, you're a professor of social and behavioral sciences at the University of Southern Maine, Lewiston Auburn College campus. And you've been teaching a course there in transforming words, poetry and psychologies of change. Tell us a little bit about that course and what that's about.
Yes. I teach in a campus which has an interdisciplinary mission and really.
Can you speak up just a little bit?
Okay, excuse me. I teach at a campus that emphasizes interdisciplinary learning. So crossing between psychology and the humanities was something that was a possible journey for me. And I gradually developed this course. I came from psychology myself in my academic training. Began to appreciate, though, how poetry, and especially and also literary writing about poetry, can add so much to our understanding of human behavior. So I developed a course that brings poetry and different types of psychology and models of change together to explore those common territories, how both speak to the human condition and can expand how we understand and sometimes change our lives.
So do you use certain kinds of poetry or certain poems and as examples and deal with that kind of thing?
Well, yes, we do bring in poems. Every class we, of course, bring in poetry. Although the main text is a book by a poet called, his name is Edward Hirsch, and it's called How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry. And in that book, he walks us through ways to appreciate poetry, because in fact many people may have had bad experiences with poetry in school early on or are a little leery of it, and also brings in samples of poems that then are written about in a way that really connects back to the psychology. So it is, we do have poetry, of course, in the classroom, but it's that text by Edward Hirsch is really our leaping off point. I also bring in a book in the course called Introspections, which is poets writing about their own poetry. So a lot of what we read about is about poetry as well as poetry and how it addresses the human condition.
Do you have some particular poems that you think of that are very apropos to this? I can think of one poem called A Visitor. Oh boy, now I'm blocking on.
Is that by Lauren?
Huh?
No, I thought maybe it was by Lawrence, but no.
No. Oh,
well,
wonderful woman poet. But anyway, it's A Visitor. I think you can find the poem online. And it's about a woman who had a very difficult relationship with her father. And he comes and visits her in a dream, and they deal with their relationship and the loss of possibilities that they never could resolve that.
It's not Mary.
Go ahead.
It doesn't like Mary Oliver.
Mary Oliver, yes.
Oh, it is.
Thank you.
Okay.
She's,
if you're going to name one poet that's used, especially in the field of poetry therapy, Mary Oliver is the primary poet. And there is an association devoted to poetry therapy, the National Association for Poetry Therapy.
That's neat.
Yeah. And I just came across a book, actually, which I think I will use. called Aftershocks, and it's a poetry of recovery for life-shattering events. 115 poets from 15 nations share their poems of recovery. So you're beginning to see anthologies out there as well that bring together poetry that can be very powerful.
And yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry, I cut you off, I think.
Oh, no, I just, it's poetry that could be very powerful in the counseling setting, anthologies pulled together. You know, a lot depends on the person, too, doesn't it, in terms of where someone is at, because I think how we respond to poetry often is a very individual matter. So usually when people work with poetry in a therapeutic setting, including poems that I bring into the classroom for educational purposes about psychology, some are hits with some people and then not for others, so you can get together a kind of a kit bag and draw from that.
Yeah, I don't use poetry very often in my therapy, but I can imagine how powerful it could be, and I would think that you would get an anthology of your own, so to speak, of the poems that you wanted to use.
That's right, because it also depends on the therapist. Again, I'm not a therapist, but poetry therapy is an area that I've read about and written about, including with my colleague Sally Bowden-Scheibel. And I know she has her file of poems, that some of which you just learn through your practice can be powerful.
Right.
Yeah.
And you guys actually wrote a paper together, right?
We did, and it's in the Journal of Poetry Therapy.
And that's in the Journal of Poetry?
Journal of Poetry Therapy.
Journal of Poetry Therapy, that was published.
And it's put out by the National Association for Poetry Therapy. And it was about the issue of timing in poetry and different processes of change, both therapeutically and on the broader scheme of things, which relates, I think, back to what Kelly was talking about, how poetry, as well as other forms of literature and institutions associated, can be very powerful on a larger scale within a community.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So, really a lot of technical difficulties this morning. I'm not sure where my co-host Hughes Kraft is. He was supposed to be joining me. You're not on, are you, Hughes? No. So I had all of these technical difficulties. I apologize for that. It's discombobulated me, I'll tell you. It must be very strange for you.
Can speak a little bit more about poetry and psychology if you'd like, or maybe Kelly wants.
Absolutely, please.
Well, one issue that's intrigued me, initially poetry is something of just a personal interest, but I began to bring it together with my teaching and writing in psychology when I began to think about the different ways they interrelate, and I'm thinking about the power of metaphor and imagery and also spaces. And when you think about now focusing on the therapeutic side of things, well, the course is not just on poetry therapy, but for your show, where giving people room to think about multiple meanings, things that they haven't been able to put into words before. There's lots of different ways to do that, but poetry can be one really valuable tool.
Do you focus on people writing poetry as well in the class?
Not in class specifically, because if it did, I'd probably lose 75% of the students the first week. we do a small group poem together, which is really a lot of fun. And
you do what?
We do a group poem together. Using that are used with children and adults, but it works with adults just as well, where each person writes a line. For instance, often the issue is to have a repetitive phrase. So we might say, talking about my town, Westbrook, or what's important, Westbrook is, or the library is, and say to each person, write one line, you've got to use that word, and you have to use a metaphor, and that would be describing one thing in terms of another, and it's got to involve your sense, one sense and an animal. And to let people just think about one line, and then it's really fun to watch how a group comes up with a set of very different lines and how you put them in different orders, shaped up in a very poetic way, what comes across. So that's as much as I build in writing of poetry, but if people do write poetry, then they can bring their poems in, and I find to use them as well. But it's more about the reading of poetry, and then also as an academic topic, the possible ways to use poetry and how it can relate to how people change, including cognitively, and not just in terms of a therapeutic setting, for sure.
Yeah, that sounds very powerful.
It has been. I was surprised. When I first offered the course, I thought I'd really have to work hard to publicize it, but if there's something for people within who want to be therapists or want to be teachers, and people who work in the arts have found it interesting, and it does have a community component as well. In fact, if we were closer to Westbrook, there could be some linkages where my students go out into the community at an organization and do something with poetry, work in the classroom, serve as a resource, or within another human service agency. And when the students go out, even if, they weren't hot about poetry themselves, and they see how excited young kids get or how an adolescent in an alternative high school finds a way to work through some things they had not been able to come to grips with in their life situation or their feelings, my students come back all charged up in terms of how powerful poetry can be. Or maybe they'll come across a poem that my students within the class readings really suddenly engage with, and that's exciting. So it has been a really fun experience.
Let me bring Kelly back in on this for a second. Kelly, what kinds of things were you reading as a young woman?
back then. Poetry-wise, I enjoyed Robert Frost.
Oh, yeah?
And then do you remember the there was a book that the children used to read, or we used to read as a child. I used to read as a child. It was just silly poems for kids. I can't remember the name of it. Uh-huh. But book-wise, one of my favorites and still is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Anything from C.S. Lewis and to, Charlotte's Web, to just all the classics. And then, as I continued to grow and still use the library, the librarians would introduce me to Stephen King, to just the well-known authors that off the top of my head I can't name any, but would grow. But the one that really sticks in my head is the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the series of books that came along with that, to the Hardy Boys. I remember reading the mystery books from that. It varied. I had a different, one day I would read poetry and the next I would, go into drawing, how to draw. Mm-hmm. So it varied as a child, but definitely The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, because it took you to another place outside what you, it took me to another place, and that's what I remember the most from reading back then.
Yeah, and you really needed to go to a different place, because the place that was surrounding
yes,
you.
Yes, you did. Yep.
Yeah.
It was there, definitely.
Yeah. So with the Robert Frost, do you remember a particular poem with Robert Frost that meant a lot to you back then?
Correct me if I'm wrong. It's the one where he had the choice between going between two paths.
The Road Less Traveled.
God. Yes. Thank you. God. Put on the spot. I'm really showing my colors here.
I want you to know this is very inspiring to me, by the way, Kelly, because I forget a lot of things, and I thought it was because I was getting old. But since you forget things too.
too many things going on at once is what I use for an excuse. I remember being introduced to Robert Peck. If I'm wrong, please correct me. But The Day No Pigs Would Die. Anything written by him was definitely my fave to read, and just Robert Frost was one. I think it was because he wrote just his way of you could visualize what he was talking about, or you could relate to fences make good friends. I could relate to it. I mean, in back then where my mom was the only income coming in, that even though I didn't have the background of a college student, I understood what he was saying, if that makes any sense.
Of course, absolutely.
Yeah, so.
I want to go back to Jan for a minute and say if if those are poems that you might work with or talk about working with in terms of the psychologies of change.
Well, it highlights the issue, yes, because I think there are different styles of poetry. And the ones that I think can be most useful in terms of both teaching and therapeutically are ones that have an initial hook for people, that can engage them, that have some kind of accessibility and imagery, and then so still leave in some that it's unsaid and allows the reader to engage and bring their own responses to that. So Robert Frost is very powerful. Emily Dickinson.
Yes.
A classic,
yes.
And very modern in many ways. I did wonder, Kelly, was it Shel Silverstein, the poet that you liked with the funny poems as a child?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is that one.
Yeah, that's one that people really like a great deal. Mary Oliver is very powerful. We mentioned that poet earlier because of the imagery of nature, I think.
Yes.
She starts
yes.
out almost with a narrative, but she always brings...
And our connection to it, yeah.
And imagery is very important in poetry. Again, some poetry does not bring in a lot of imagery, but it's often a defining feature of many kinds of poetry. Because that's one way that it can access different parts of our experience and mind that are not fully articulated yet in terms of words and consciousness.
Yeah. So I want to call in now my friend and colleague, Dr. Mark Kiefner, with A Minute on the Mind with Dr. Mark Kiefner. Are you there, Mark?
I am, Jim. How are you guys?
We're doing pretty well. After a rocky start, these guys really bailed me out and just started all on their own. They couldn't hear me, but they did a great
Hughes
job.
Hughes went here today?
Now I don't know where Hughes is. So it was quite a change for me, but I'm so grateful. So what do you got for us on the Minute on the Mind, Dr. Kiefner?
Well, I was just listening to the last few minutes, and it's fascinating. There's so many things to talk about. I really resonate talking about that limbic resonance thing from last week. I really resonate with the value of libraries and reading. I grew up in 7 kids and 2 parents in a row house in Baltimore, and the library was my the only private space in the whole town.
I relate to that.
So I can totally understand the power of the library and the power of words. What I thought might be interesting is to talk about those of us who had difficulty with reading, people with dyslexia, and interestingly, there was a neurologist, Samuel Horton, in Baltimore, who teamed up in 1925 with a psychologist named Anna Gillingham, and he was interested in kids who had trouble reading. And he had this whole theory that there was some kind of problem with cell development in the left hemisphere. And it turns out that he was right, and they developed a whole method of multisensory instruction, which focused on teaching people phonemic processing. Because when the cells in the left hemisphere don't develop properly, we have difficulty with understanding how words work phonetically. And that phonetic processing is kind of the basis for reading and to some extent for spelling. So their approach, the Orton-Gillingham approach, is still fairly popular and kind of the basis for a number of other instructional methods like reading recovery, Wilson method, that are used for helping people with reading disabilities. And that's the minute on reading disabilities, and it's a much more complex subject than that, but that's about what you can squeeze into a minute. And if you want me to address the forgetting issue at some other point, I've got a lot of thoughts about that.
We may have a series on that.
Forgetting. 2, 3,
that might
four.
Be a whole day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
anyway.
Well, anyway, we've got to go. We've packed in a ton of stuff into this hour. And I, again, thank my guests very much, and thank you, Mark, for that interesting minute about, not only the possibility of reading, but sometimes the difficulty with reading. So, see you next week with another Darn Guys show. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Well, in the evening, we get together. Long day.